From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
All of a sudden, I see this thing thrown on the floor, and I hear a big boom, like a bomb. And then the rug caught on fire, and then he's one side to the other, get water. And so they get a pot of water and put it, you know, put out the smoke from the rug. And so I say, gee, what are you doing in my house? I haven't done anything.
The words of Timothy Brockman, a retired Marine and factory worker, New York police raided his home. He'll tell his story, and we'll hear others. We'll also be joined by Manhattan Borough President Virginia Fields.
Thank you. And clearly, we must do something so that innocent people in their homes do not feel that they are being unduly attacked by those who have the responsibility for ensuring safety, our police officers.
And embedded reporters. We take a look after the invasion.
Journalists need to draw conclusions about whether journalistic objectivity was compromised during the war. The military needs to consider whether the strain of taking care of us and protecting us and giving us dangerous information was an undue burden on them.
New York Times reporter Judith Miller, she's facing scrutiny for her close ties to Ahmed Chalabi, as well as her questionable reporting on weapons of mass destruction. We'll speak with the publisher of Harper's Magazine, Rick MacArthur. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Corporate lobbyists representing big businesses, including Citigroup, R.J. Reynolds Tobacco, and Microsoft, are pushing the Senate to confirm President Bush's nominees for federal judges at the same time that many of these companies face lawsuits in the very courts the nominees would serve. This, according to a report by the Associated Press. The lobbying is being orchestrated by C. Boyden Gray, who served as counsel to the first President Bush. Charles Lewis, director of the Center for Public Integrity, called Gray's committee a, quote, unabashed, aggressive attempt to influence judges. Lewis added, the last thing our court system needs is more questions about its credibility. The White House has suspended military aid to 35 countries. Because they have signed on the International Criminal Court without exempting Americans from possible prosecution. Countries include Brazil, Colombia, Ireland, Peru, South Africa, Switzerland, and Venezuela. At least 9 Iraqis are now believed to be dead following a large explosion at a Sunni mosque in Fallujah. Among the dead was an outspoken cleric, Laith Khalil, who called for a religious war to expel U.S. troops from Iraq. The cause of the blast is still unknown. Local residents blame the U.S., but the Pentagon says evidence indicates the explosion occurred from inside the mosque. Meanwhile, on Tuesday, President Bush pledged that U.S. troops will not pull out of Iraq despite the ongoing attacks on the troops. Israeli troops are expected to withdraw from Bethlehem today, one day after talks occurred between Israeli Prime Minister General Ariel Sharon and his Palestinian counterpart, Mahmoud Abbas. The two leaders agreed to move forward on the U.S.-backed peace plan known as the Roadmap to Peace. The Pentagon is developing a project called, quote, Combat Zones That See, that would allow military officials to track and identify every vehicle and its passengers in a city by using high-tech computers and a team of cameras. The images would be automatically analyzed by computers. Warning messages would be generated if a wanted vehicle or person was located. The Pentagon is saying it needs the program to keep watch on foreign cities during military conflicts, but privacy experts say the technology could be adapted to spy on Americans. The project is being overseen by DARPA. This news on the 2004 presidential race. It is estimated President Bush has raised $34 million in the past 6 weeks for his campaign, far more than any of his counterparts in the Democratic Party. The top Democratic fundraiser during the last 3 months appears to be former Vermont Governor Howard Dean, who raised about $7.5 million. Dean surprised Washington insiders by raising $3 million alone through the internet over the past week, in part due to his success in the online primary organized by the group MoveOn.org. President Bush is expected to announce that Randall Tobias will head the White House's $15 billion program to fight AIDS in Africa and the Caribbean. Tobias is the former chair and CEO of the pharmaceutical giant Eli Lilly. The Washington Post reports Tobias's biography suggests little direct experience working on AIDS, but extensive experience with pharmaceuticals and corporations. Tobias and Eli Lilly have both been major donors to the Republican Party. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan yesterday urged the United States to head an international peacekeeping force to Liberia to halt a worsening civil war. The UN estimates that at least 5,000 troops are needed. A new report by the General Accounting Office has found officials from the Agriculture Department are helping U.S. tobacco companies export their products despite congressional restrictions. The report found the agency's Foreign Agricultural Service still provides tobacco companies with analysis of what countries to target, either because of weak tobacco control laws or high interest in U.S. cigarettes. The New York Times is reporting the U.S. has been secretly building a mobile germ plant that may have violated the 1975 global ban on germ weapons. It was built to help U.S. forces detect such mobile units in Iraq. The Times reports that among those working on the top secret project was Dr. Stephen Hatfill, who has been identified by the Justice Department as a, quote, person of interest in the anthrax attacks. We gotta have peace to keep the world alive and war to cease. We gotta have joy true in our hearts with strength we can't destroy. People hear us through our voice. The world knows there's no choice. We're begging, save. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. A Brooklyn man died Saturday, 10 days after suffering a heart attack, after police raided his house. Calvin Washington had a history of heart trouble, died of cardiac arrest while in the hospital. He was 41 years old. His widow, Yvonne Washington, accused police officers of causing his death by storming into the family's Bedford-Stuyvesant home. The police say they were pursuing their son, Taheem Washington. On June 18th, 40 uniformed and plainclothes officers broke down the door to the house while Yvonne was making dinner. The Amsterdam News reports Yvonne is saying that the police did not explain why they invaded the house when she insisted an officer grabbed her and another officer knocked her baby down. Calvin, who had a history of heart trouble, was in the bedroom attached to his defibrillator. Yvonne screamed at the officers her husband needed help. They didn't respond. Meanwhile, as police rushed up the stairs to the second floor, they crushed one of Washington's 9 cats, killing it, severely injuring another. Afraid for her husband's condition, Yvonne eventually dialed 911, in effect calling the police on the police. Calvin was taken to the hospital in an ambulance and died 10 days later. The incident comes in a spate of so-called mistaken police raids in New York. A little more than a month ago, Alberta Spruill suffered a heart attack and died after the police mistakenly kicked down her door and tossed a flash grenade into her apartment. She had worked for the city for more than 30 years. Today on Democracy Now!, we'll hear about some of these stories, and we're going to be joined by Virginia Fields, who is the Manhattan Borough President. But we thought we'd start with Timothy Brockman. His house was raided in May. The New York Police Department broke down the door, threw in a stun grenade. Last night, we reached Mr. Brockman, who walks with a walker or using a wheelchair, and asked him to describe what took place last May.
I'm laying down, getting my sleep. It's about a quarter after seven, and I hear this scratching at the door. So I'm wondering who's scratching at my door. Then I heard a boom, and the door flew open. And the squad team, about eight guys, come running in with the gas masks and the shields. And they're running through the house, and I'm saying, what is this? What's going on? What are you doing in my house? And my cats are running like crazy, Tito and Rocky. And I said, what's going on? So somebody says, get on the floor, get on the floor. I said, get on the floor. I said, I'm a sick man. Don't you see I have medical equipment when I'm laying down in bed? Get on the floor. So I see the guns and everything or whether I'm imagining it or not, but I know they're cops and I don't want to make a mistake and get myself shot here. So I struggled to get on the floor. And then he says, put your hands behind your back. So I put my hands behind my back, and I'm saying, what are you doing in my house? I haven't done anything wrong. What's going on here? And then all of a sudden, I see this thing thrown on the floor, and I hear a big boom, like a bomb. And then the rug caught on fire, and then he's one side to the other, get water. And so they got a pot of water and put it, you know, put out the smoke from the rug. So I say, gee, what are you doing in my house? I haven't done anything. And then in the meantime, the lady across the hall, she's running out with her kids. She's dressing, and the kids are half-dressed, and she wants to get out the house because she doesn't know what's going on. And later, she showed me a bruise on her arm where she had bumped against something trying to get her kids out of the house into safety. And then the squad team, they left, and then some other cops came in. And then they started asking me a lot of questions about somebody said that I'm dealing in guns and drugs. So I said, no. I said, you definitely have come to the wrong place. I do not do any of that kind of stuff what you're saying I'm doing. See, I said, yeah, it's uncomfortable here on the floor, so he says to somebody, lift them up and put them on the bed. So they put me on the end of the bed. I almost fell down. I said, no, can't you put me in the center of the bed? And then they put me in the center of the bed. So I said, look, I haven't done anything. What's with the handcuffs? Can't you give me a break here? So he says to somebody, he says, well, take the handcuffs off. So they take the handcuffs off, and then I'm saying, I'm worried about my cats. I hope you didn't hurt my cats, or they didn't hurt themselves, because this stun bomb gives off some smoke or something, some kind of degree came out, and so they had to open up all the windows. So I'm scared maybe my cats, in their fright, jump out the windows, you know? So I didn't see them. So they questioned me about, do you have anybody coming into your house, like traffic or something like that, or maybe somebody come in that might be dealing in illegal things? I said, no. I said, if I know anybody like that, I wouldn't know them as friends. And I said, they would not come into my home. I said, I do not allow people like that into my home. So then two officers come in from the street. They said they was looking at the window from the outside, so in case I throw something out the window, you know, to clean up my house, I throw drugs or guns or whatever it was they're looking for. So one officer says to the other, he says, you know, I got a very funny feeling about this. He says, because people like we are looking for don't have yellow ribbon in the window, you know, praying that the guys come home safely. And so they went through the house, and they, well, naturally, they're not going to find anything into it. So they questioned me for quite a while, and whatever they asked me, and then I made a reply. And then they said, all right, he says, we're going to leave. I said, but what about my door? Because the door was twisted. You couldn't close the door again. You could hardly get it open because this machine that blew it open left it in unusable. So he says, don't worry about it. I'm going to call up and have the door replaced. So then after a while, some people from the city came, you know, the workers, and then they replaced the door, you know? And, that was it. I was feeling bad about it because, I mean, like I'm saying to myself, trouble comes to you. You don't have to look for trouble. I say, all of a sudden, what have I done that people's going to come in on me like this, you know, and disturb my lifestyle, you know, because I'm sick. I'm a sick man, and I'm trying to get myself together wherein that I'll be able to function properly. And then all of a sudden this happens, they put more stress on me. And then my cats, I couldn't find them for about 2 or 3 hours. They hid someplace under the couch. And, they're still affected by it because when somebody strangers come to the door, they go into hiding. And, I don't know. It sort of slows me down because, I mean, health-wise, and I haven't been watching myself too closely. And, like, I've been going to the hospital. I'm getting treatment for prostate, and I had open heart surgery and seizures, a lot of complications, and I'm trying to get myself together, and this all of a sudden comes in on me, and I'm saying I'm sort of disgusted, you know, and I try not to. I don't want to be a grumpy. So I try to say, hey, this is a mistake, something that I have to deal with. Hopefully it doesn't happen again. I see no reason why it should happen again. I mean, because a mistake like this here, it could have cost me my life. If I had made a wrong move or something, or somebody got nervous, I could have got shot and killed.
Timothy Brockman. He's a retired Marine, factory worker, was a security guard at the Bronx Zoo, describing a New York Police Department raid on his home in May. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back from our 60-second break, we'll be joined by Manhattan Borough President Virginia Fields, and we'll hear about another police raid. Stay with us.
DC, all should live as one brothers. This is the time that we all should live as one sisters. So come along, brothers, and come along, sisters. Unity is unity. So come along, brothers and sisters. Living in today, sisters. So come along, brothers, and come along, sisters.
Desmond Dekker here on Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As we talk about the spate of New York Police Department raids, we're joined by Manhattan Borough President Virginia Fields. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
It's great to have you. Timothy Brockman's story, how unusual is it? And how did you start to get involved in these cases?
Unfortunately, Timothy Brockman's story is a tragedy. Justice Alberta Sprouls was a tragedy. And following a hearing conducted by my office on June 5th, we learned that all too often these tragedies are occurring here in New York City as a result of the no-knock warrants being executed by the New York Police Department. Back in May, the latter part of May, I suppose, the first part of June or so, immediately in the aftermath of Alberta Sprouls' death, we opened up a hotline, 1-800 number, and just asked people throughout the city, anyone who had found themselves a victim of these no-knock warrants, to please call. Within a matter of 5 days, we had received in excess of 100 calls. They were screened and monitored by my staff. Some of the reports were taken over the phone. Others were brought in, and more than one person sat down with them to hear their story. Then we conducted a public hearing where about 10 of those callers were asked to come and testify in terms of what happened to them. Very similar to what we just heard and saw, heard from Mr. Brockman, that, police officers came in, no knock, immediately thrown to the floor. Many of the people were seniors. Several of them were retired police officers or retired correction officers, where they made it clear that they, in fact, had guns in their home. One retired police officer had been able to get his gun when he heard the noise, so he was lying on it, and he kept telling the officers, I'm on a gun, just in case they found it, and, of course, responded to that. So you had retired seniors, you had young mothers, you had children. In every case, the story was the same, that there were no drugs, there were no guns, that these were hardworking people. They were people who were law-abiding citizens just trying to do the right thing, and clearly their rights had been violated, and they felt left in a state of shock, confusion, and frustration, and emotional problems. I know one situation where the gentleman who is retired now, he is a cancer victim, and even as his wife explained the condition that he had, similar to Mr. Brockman as far as health problems, nothing was done. The other similarities were that the language used by the police officers as spoken by all of the victims was most disrespectful. In some cases where they were asked to loosen the handcuffs because it was stopping circulation, they were laughed at. But in every case, according to the complainants, nothing was found. Some of them have moved forward in terms of taking next steps, but some of them have not.
2 days after the police raided Timothy Brockman's apartment, they raided Alberta Sprouls' apartment. The 57-year-old city worker who died of a heart attack after police burst into her apartment in Harlem on May 16th with a stun grenade in search of a person who did not live there and who was actually in custody. In the case of Timothy Brockman, the police ultimately said that they had gotten wrong information, that a woman who had been an informant had gone into an apartment, seen people dealing drugs, had left the apartment, and then they asked her to mark it so that they could raid it. She went to the wrong building, and she marked Timothy Brockman's apartment. The raid into his apartment got almost no attention at the time. And then, of course, 2 days later, Alberta Spruill. We have on the line with us Emerit Espadi. She is the mother of a 12-year-old girl who was alone at home at 7 o'clock in the morning on May 22nd, 1 week after the police raided Alberta Spruill's apartment. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Emerit Espadi.
Hi, good morning.
It's very good to have you with us, and I know that you have your daughter at your side. I was wondering if you could tell us what happened on May 22nd.
Well, on May 22nd, I'm a registered nurse. I usually leave the house at 5 to 7 to go to work, and my daughter stays home. Her father lives downstairs, you know, about 7:45 or so he'd be taking her to go to school. So that morning about 8 o'clock, I heard my daughter calling me frantically on the phone. She's crying, "Mommy, Mommy, the police is in the house, the police is in the house." You know, 8 o'clock, and I just left an hour ago. So, you know, I'm puzzled. I said, "Why?" She says, "I don't know, they're in the house." So I said, "Let me speak to the police." So I spoke to a gentleman who said he's, I said, "Why, what you doing in my house?" "Ma'am, we got a warrant to search your house." I just dropped everything. You know, I asked my boss. I came home. When I came home, it was about 8:30, and I didn't see my daughter. Apparently, my daughter, they had released her, go to school. But I spoke to a gentleman. He told me he was Sergeant Dolan from the NYPD, that he had a search warrant for my house. And that he showed me that, you know, according to an informant, that I had drugs and a certain amount of guns that I don't even know the names. Anyway, when I came into my house, my door had broken into. The door was definitely broken. My house was ransacked. So I conversed with the police. Then my most important thing was my daughter. So about 9:10 o'clock, I went to pick up my daughter in the school. When I met my daughter was in shock. And I found out that my daughter told me that when the police came in the house about 7:30, she was just about to leave. And she, in the kitchen, she heard a boom sound, like someone dropped, someone from upstairs fell. Apparently, that was the police breaking the door. And as she was about to open the door, curiously, as she reached to open the door had already pushed up on her, which is my door, because you have to go a couple of stairs from the front door to go to my second floor apartment. Then she said that at the same time, she didn't know what hit her. She thought she was dreaming, because there was a bunch of people with gears and guns and a shield. It was so noisy. She lost it for a minute, but she remembered they telling her, "Drop on the floor, get on the floor." We have a couple of stairs by in the kitchen. She stumbled into the stairs, and some of them, the uniform gears and everything, people were going into every room. But she remembered three of them pointed guns at her, the long rifles. They pointed the three of them. She was on the floor, and with her hand behind her back, they pointed the rifles and tell her, "Don't move, don't move." So they handcuffed her. When they handcuffed her, after they handcuffed her, those three people, you know, stopped pointing the rifles on her. And they kept looking all over, ransacking my apartment. And they had her in handcuffs for over 25 minutes. And she kept saying, "I want to call my mom. I want to call my mom." Nobody allowed her to call her mom. She says later on, there was when all these people start to go in the other apartments in the house. My house is a three apartments, the first floor, the second floor, and the third floor, and the basement. They go from up and down. And she said to them, "I need to call my mom, call my mom." Then about, like, she says, like, 5 minutes to eight or something, a lady officer asks her, how old are you? She says, I'm 12. Then she says, well, she should not, this kid should not have been in handcuffs. So they took her handcuffs off. But yet she said, can I call my mom now? Can I call my mom now? Nobody allowed her to call me. So 5 minutes later, then I received a frantic call. Okay, so, but I didn't know all that happens. When I found that my daughter, my 12-year-old daughter, my daughter is an honest student, a very good girl. I have no problem with her. And I am a nurse. You know, I'm a hardworking woman. You know, I'm as clean and decent as they come. Okay, for me to hear that my daughter was in handcuffs, guns pointed at her, the worst thing, she says, Mommy, I thought I was going to die. I thought they were going to kill me. Because she's aware of the raid in Harlem that occurred a couple of days before that. She says, Mommy, I thought they were going to kill me like that lady. I thought that I was never going to see you again. And I you can imagine a 12-year-old watching her life flash right in front of her, in her own house, her own kitchen.
Is your daughter with you right now, Emery Tespadi?
Yes, she is.
Could you put her on the phone?
Okay, hold on. Hello?
Hi.
Hi.
Can you tell me your name?
I'm Jennifer Estudy.
Jennifer, can you talk about this morning, the morning that your mother just described in May? Did the police knock on the door and you opened it?
No, I just heard a boom and I felt someone fell from the third floor. And I was about to open the door, and that was when they busted in, and they told me to get on the floor, and they handcuffed me, and guns were pointed at my face.
What were you thinking at the time? What were you saying?
I thought I was going to die. I didn't say that, but that's what I thought was going to happen.
Did anyone talk to you, explain what was happening?
No. They didn't say anything. I was just frantic. I didn't know what was happening. And they just went to my room, every single room in the apartment, and they ransacked it looking for drugs and stuff.
They put handcuffs on you?
Yeah.
Were you able to call your mother?
After about 25 minutes.
And how have you been since? You went off to school that morning?
Yeah, because I didn't want to stay home. I wanted to be somewhere else.
And what have your thoughts been since about what happened?
I'm still scared about it, and I hope it doesn't happen to anyone else.
We tried to call the police department. They refused to come on the mayor's office as well. Did you talk to other kids in your class about what took place?
Some of my friends.
Has that ever happened to them?
No.
Are you able to sleep at night?
Not really.
Do you have any thoughts you'd like to share with the police right now?
Excuse me?
Do you have any thing you would like to say to the police right now?
They shouldn't have done that to anybody. It's been happening too much. And people could die, and they shouldn't do it again because it's wrong.
As you listen to this, Virginia Fields, your thoughts?
That is the same story we have heard over and over from those who called on our hotline, from those who spoke at our hearings, and, of course, what we're hearing today. And I think the young lady, Jennifer, I think it was her name, said it best that, you know, something has to be done. It is in that spirit that we have offered some concrete recommendations to the police department, to the district attorney, and to the administrative judge of the criminal courts here in New York, for follow-up, because in each instance, take for example the medical situation. One recommendation is that emergency medical services should be a part of any team that is executing such warrants, so that if there is a Mr. Brockman, if there is the case of the gentleman who eventually died last week, who was 41 years old and had a heart problem, that medical attention can be given immediately and that there are no questions asked. But more importantly, we also suggest that surveillance must be confirmed and independently confirmed by police officers and verified even before a warrant is issued. Because as in the last case, a confidential informant put an X on the wrong door. So that most of this information comes, quite frankly, from confidential informants, some who are drug dealers, some who have criminal records, but that's the nature of that game. However, once that information is provided, we are recommending that it be mandated that police officers independently conduct surveillances so that they can have a better sense of what is actually going on in that location. Confirm information as to who lives there, because clearly if that had been done in the case of Mrs. Spruill, it would have been known that a 57-year-old, hard-working city worker lived there, and that could have been substantiated by those who live there also. So that does not happen now, and we think that it is important that it is mandated and not simply be a policy that may or may not be followed. Other recommendations speak to issues that have been raised as the warrants themselves. Currently, judges are able to sign warrants just based on police and district attorney asking for it. We're suggesting that in each county of New York, there is a set of what we call no-knock warrant judges, so that only certain judges can actually sign such warrants after certain steps have been verified to have been taken, and that there is certainly information that they have, knowing that this is the way to go. Because perhaps there are instances, I'm sure, in the city in terms of police work where sometime no-knock warrants may very well be necessary, but that we all want to have a level of guarantee and assurance that this is where it has to go. So those are some of the recommendations that we have made, along with what Mr. Brockman said about the door. It's interesting. One would think that after these raids are conducted or executed, that the doors would be fixed. No drugs. These are hardworking people. Mistake, irrespective of the fact that it is the address that the warrant held. But it's unclear as to who is to repair the door. Mr. Brockman was lucky because in many of the instances where we heard from people, their doors were never repaired.
And where does this all take place? You're the borough president for all of Manhattan.
Yes.
Where are the complaints coming from?
The complaints in terms of the people who called the hotline and spoke were from across the city, all five boroughs, including Staten Island.
In terms of socioeconomic class, in terms of lobbying clout, do you think it would happen in all aspects of the city,
in all parts
of the city?
The reality is that these no-knock warrants are being executed predominantly in African-American and Latino communities. That is fact. You look at all of them in terms of the callers and as well as what has been made available from the police department. Now, the commissioner states that the no-knock warrants are executed based on where the crime information leads them, and these are the communities where it is leading them. I have no doubt, again, as I said, that in some instances, no knocks might be the only way that the police are able to do that. But there still must be procedures to be followed. Even procedures were not followed in the case of Mrs. Spruill. And they have documented that. But more importantly, I think it goes to other concerns. What are we doing to combat crime overall? And what are we doing to protect innocent people in cases of these no-knock warrants?
If people want to get in touch with you, where can they call?
They can certainly call my office at 212-669-8300. 212-669-8300.
You know, it's interesting. Bernard Carrick, the former police chief, has just come back from Iraq. One of the major concerns of Iraqis and the reports we're getting in the last days is the anger of Iraqi families families when the U.S. troops raid their homes. And they're describing the same stories that we're hearing here in New York City.
And that's incredible, certainly here in New York City. No one should feel that you're sitting having dinner or just awake and getting ready to go to work and boom. The police department, people we pay to provide, you know, protection and safety, are the ones bursting into our homes. Another recommendation I want to mention has to do with the Civilian Complaint Review Board, because what we learned is that under the guidelines of the Civilian Complaint Review Board, as long as the address is the same as the one on the warrant, that is considered a good warrant. Therefore, they will not take those cases. And many of these people who, if they cannot afford a private lawyer, have no place to go.
Last point. Our own engineer here on Democracy Now!, Rich Kim, as he came to work just a few days ago, his roommate was home. The police knocked. There were four or five of them. She opened the door. And for a moment, they said they had a warrant. They put their foot in the door, and then they pushed their way in, and they raided the apartment. She was asking what she couldn't figure out, what they were looking for, what they were doing, and they left. They called the local police precinct. They said, do you have the name? Did the police give you a card? She said, no.
Right.
And so they said, well, then you'd have to call the warrants office. We know nothing about it. She called the warrants office, and they said, do you have information about who the police were? She said, no. They said, then we can't help you. Goodbye. So how often is this helping, and what can people do when it does happen? Often they're so traumatized they can't get the names of police. They cannot see the warrant. They're so traumatized they don't even know what it is, and the police move right in.
Unfortunately, if you don't have a name or you don't have a copy of a warrant, there's very little you can do in terms of following through to make charges.
Doesn't the local police precinct know what they did?
No. No. The local precinct, in most instances, are not the ones from which the warrant comes. As in the case of Mrs. Spruill, she lives in the 3-2 in terms of where her home was. This was executed by the 2-5. There was no communication from the 2-5 to the 3-2, and the 3-2 might very well have known more about the building. So that's why I think it is inherent upon necessary for the mayor and the police commissioner to make systemic changes, not just cosmetic stuff. They must go and make systemic changes and make sure that these procedures are followed, because in instances like that, there is nowhere for the person to go. They don't have a name. They don't have a badge number. They don't have a copy of a warrant. And we were told by many of the complainants that the only way they receive the copy of the warrant is that they ask for it. Some cases, the police officers allegedly threw it at them or dropped it on the floor. That's the only way they got information.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Manhattan Borough President Virginia Fields in the studio with us here at Democracy Now! And when we come back, we're going to take a look at war reporting. We're joined in the studio by Harper's publisher Rick MacArthur. Stay with us.
My friend is feels their appointed duty. They keep trying to tell me and I'm sure he meant well.
but when I talk was through, I said, brother, if you only knew, you'd wish that you were in my shoes. You just keep on using.
Bill Withers here on Democracy Now. I'm Amy Goodman. Embedded reporters' role in armies, in army units' actions questioned by military. That's the headline in a recent article by the Washington Post media critic Howard Kurtz. The article begins, New York Times reporter Judith Miller played a highly unusual role in an army unit assigned to search for dangerous Iraqi weapons, according to U.S. military officials, prompting criticism that the unit was turned into what one official called a rogue operation. More than a half dozen military officers said that Miller acted as a middleman between the army unit with which she was embedded and Iraqi National Congress leader Ahmed Chalabi, on one occasion accompanying army officers to Chalabi's headquarters where they took custody of Saddam Hussein's son-in-law. She also sat in the initial debriefing of the son-in-law, these sources say. Since interrogating Iraqis was not the mission of the unit, these officials said it became a Judith Miller team, in the words of one officer close to the situation. The article goes on to report Miller also took part in a military ceremony in Baghdad where the leader of the Met Alpha team was promoted. She pinned the rank to his uniform and he publicly thanked her for her contributions. The Post also quotes officers who say Miller used her power as a reporter for the New York Times and her connections in the Pentagon to influence decisions by the military. When the Army considered withdrawing the mobile exploitation team Alpha from an Iraqi town, Miller complained to a two-star general, and she threatened to write negative stories in the New York Times. The pullback order was soon rescinded. Well, today we're joined by Rick MacArthur, publisher of Harper's Magazine and author of Second Front, Censorship and Propaganda in the Gulf War. We've called Judith Miller on this occasion and others to try to get her on. We haven't succeeded, but we did get a tape of her address at the graduation of Barnard College. This is just an excerpt of what she had to say.
Does one lose one's journalistic objectivity when one's life literally depends on such people? Probably. Was the risk worth it? For me, definitely. But I believe that my profession needs to conduct what the military calls an AAR, an after-action report on this embedding experience. Journalists need to draw conclusions about whether journalistic objectivity was compromised during the war. The military needs to consider whether the strain of taking care of us and protecting us and giving us dangerous information was an undue burden on them. And we all need to debate together now whether the country's interests were best served by this arrangement.
Judith Miller at Barnard graduation. Rick MacArthur, publisher of Harper's Magazine, your response.
Well, it's my response is to say that the New York Times has really shifted from being what I used to call Pravda, which was, of course, the Soviet Union Communist Party paper, to Izvestia, which was the Soviet Union government newspaper. Because this indicates, or this shows better than anything I've said, and I've been screaming about this since September, that the New York Times is now functioning as the semi-official or quasi-official government newspaper of the United States. And they've gone to the extent of actually promoting administration policies. They really helped start the war in Iraq. And this, and I don't want to bore people with ancient history, but it's urgently important that you go back and read the New York Times or any other American newspaper, big newspaper, from September 7th to October 10th, which is when Congress voted the war authorization. And look at the stuff that they were reporting then, the atomic bomb scare stories that Judith Miller, Michael Gordon, and her friend, their colleague Patrick Tyler, were promoting on the front page of the New York Times. This is indicative of institutional corruption. Judith Miller can't do this sort of junk without the encouragement, the sanction, the permission, I don't know how else to put it, of the owners, the people who manage the New York Times. And if you think that the Times is an objective newspaper, if you ever thought it was an objective newspaper, take a look at this stuff. This is a reporter who's not only bought and sold herself out completely to the interests of power. It's a reporter who's running around actually acting as an agent for the Pentagon or for the White House, because what she's doing here is she's pushing around the Army. She's telling the Army officers, the superior Army, who think that the Met Alpha unit is a fraud, and you'll find plenty of regular Army people who will say that this whole business of trying to find the pretext, I call them the pretext justification unit, which that is the pretext for the war, that this is all a put-up job, it's all phony. And you've got a reporter for the New York Times saying to high-ranking Army officers, don't you dare push me around. Don't you dare pull my friends out, my weapons finders, because I've got the full weight of the New York Times and the implication is of the Pentagon behind me. Now, this is really alarming for anybody who's interested in the press or in having a democratic system in this country. I was talking to Gene McCarthy about this just yesterday, my great hero who ran the insurgency against LBJ in 68 and knocked him out of office. He could have become president. And I was saying to him, which I frequently say, well, you can't. It's too much to ask of the media to provide opposition in a time when there's no political opposition, there's no formal opposition political party. And he said, no, you can't think that way. The media's got to do it because it's hopeless. You're not going to get the Democrats to call out Bush or the New York Times on this. The media itself has to do it. So the one encouraging thing that's going on here is that the Washington Post, evidently, institutionally, is so disgusted with what they're seeing over at the Times that they feel they need to report on it.
Washington Post also reported on the leaked email that said that it was Ahmed Chalabi who, to say the least, wants to rule Iraq, wanted to move in quickly, was the source for most of the weapons of mass destruction stories. And this was a secret email between Judith Miller and her colleague at the New York Times, John Burns, where he was challenging her on this.
Right. Even within the paper, obviously people are upset because in the post-Jason Blair atmosphere at the Times, which to me is like it's like the Politburo. It's like trying to understand what went on in the Soviet Politburo. There are wheels within wheels and so on, but there obviously is an internal debate going on at the paper about what its role should be, what it should have been during the war, what it has become after the war. But by and large, the Times is still defending, institutionally defending Judith Miller and defending what they did. The key line in the story, the key quote, I can't find it here. Anyway, Andrew Rosenthal, Judith Miller's boss, her immediate boss at the Times, says, I think she did a great job. I think she broke a lot of important stories. And he's defending her. Now, this is somebody who should have been fired from the paper long before Jason Blair or put on obits or I don't know what. They should have given her something where she couldn't do any harm. This goes deeper. I wrote a column about this a couple of weeks ago, pointing out that Michael Lewis, the author of Liar's Poker, best-selling author of Moneyball, had taken $15,000 from Merrill Lynch to help promote their internet investment fund back in 2001. He wrote a piece for the New York Times Magazine last fall defending Merrill Lynch against Elliot Spitzer's investigation. Did not reveal that he had taken money from Merrill Lynch. This is institutional corruption. This is the Times acting as spokesman for Wall Street and spokesman for the government. And I, believe me, I was one of those people who never signed on to what is charmingly referred to as left-wing conspiracy theories about the New York Times and about the press. But things are worse than I've ever seen them before.
The New York Times, when they said it was their 152-year low, the whole story of Jason Blair, the reporter who was fabricating stories, it's called the Blair Affair. I thought it is a 152-year low for the New York Times, but it's the low is the invasion of Iraq. I call it the Bush-Blair Affair, right. Is the real reason for their low. We're also joined on the phone, though, by Jules Crittenden, who is a reporter for the Boston Herald, who was an embedded reporter reporter in Iraq, and was recently down at the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee conference, where he's talking about Iraq and defending, for example, pointing out Iraqis that, well, perhaps to be shot to the soldiers he was with. Jules Crittenden is on the line with us. Jules, would you say that that is an accurate description of what you were doing?
Well, I think what I'd like to address, which is the topic at hand, which is Judith Miller. And I think it, in light of everything Rick has just said here, I think it's important to point out that what we have is one report based on a bunch of secondhand unnamed sources in a competing newspaper. So on that basis, I'm kind of hesitant to start second-guessing another reporter's work. You know, I think that there are some very interesting and in some cases possibly disturbing questions that are raised by everything that we've read here. But I think that we have yet to get the full story on this. You know, regarding embedding, it's a very interesting process, and I think that, you know, when Judith Miller said there needs to be an after-action report, I think that, that does need to happen. I think it is happening in these kind of discussions that we're having here and that a number of people have been having elsewhere. I think that it does, you know, create some conflicts, creates a lot of challenges, but I think at the same time it creates great opportunities to bear witness. It's not entirely clear to me because I know that there can be a lot of perspectives, and within the military or within any other institution, actions can be interpreted in a lot of different ways, particularly by people who may have access to grind. So it's not clear to me how much truth, where the truth might begin and the perception continues in the whole Judith Miller story. Again, we've got one story in a competing newspaper here.
What do you say?
You have a lot more than that. Excuse me. You go back and look at the story that she and Michael Gordon wrote on, published on September 8th on the front page of the Times about the aluminum tubes, and you see the progression of fact or
well,
alleged facts.
Really
wait.
Yeah, I know, but you just had about 10 minutes.
No.
Like
the head of the nuclear, the International Atomic Energy Agency, Al-Baradei, just has absolutely smashed to bits the New York Times reporting going back to September. So it's not as though nothing they've reported has been refuted up until now. So
yeah, well, I didn't
You said that's a Judith Miller story going back to September.
What I'm referring to here is the Kurt story about whether she's directing military operations
right.
and that sort
okay.
of thing. And I think that
she has a record of fraudulent reporting.
I'm going to ask, we do have to end the program, but I want to ask if you could both come back tomorrow and we could have a further discussion about this. I think it's extremely important, and the whole discussion of the embed versus the inbed. And I think, Jules Crittenden, you have very interesting insight having been there. So if we could have you back tomorrow, we only have 30 seconds left for us to outro the show. We're talking with Jules Crittenden of the Boston Herald and also Rick MacArthur, publisher of Harper's Magazine. That does it for the program. If you want to get a copy, you can call 1-800-881-2359, 1-800-881-2359. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Sharif Abdul Qudus, Anna Nogueira, Elizabeth Press, Noah Rybal, Vilka Tsouras, Mike DeFilippo, and Rich Kim are our engineers. Our website is democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us. That I ought not to let you just walk on me.